From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Indira Lakshmanan of the Poynter Institute for Media Studies. This is On Point. There are about 5.6 million people in the United States living with dementia, and more than 45 million worldwide. That number is expected to triple by 2050. Many of us are caregivers to loved ones suffering from the disease, and many more worry we might someday be affected ourselves. While you're still of sound mind, should you lay out the medical care you want if you're diagnosed with dementia? Now, thanks to a new directive, you can. This hour on Point, a new plan for dementia care. You can join us on air or online. Would you fill out an advance directive for dementia? Families, would you honor those wishes? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Seattle, Washington, is Dr. Barak Gaster, professor of medicine at the University of Washington School of Medicine. He created a dementia-specific advance directive. You can find it and a link to our form on our website, onpointradio.org. Dr. Gaster, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So you're an internal medicine doctor, and you are very often any patient's first stop for any ailment. What sorts of symptoms and stories do patients present that make you suspect they may have dementia?
That's one of the hardest things in primary care, because it's totally normal and natural that as people get older, their memory is not as good as it used to be. Forgetting where you put your keys, what is the name of that that old friend of yours? Those are super common things that happen to everyone as they get older. And trying to distinguish between those normal changes with aging and what might be the first signs of dementia is really, really difficult. And so, to some extent, people saying, I'm worried about my memory is a little bit helpful, but a lot of people are aware of that and worry about that, and it's not necessarily dementia. And so it really is things like people repeating the exact same story that they told 30 minutes ago and forgot that they told it, or getting disoriented or lost in a area that they have been to many, many times before. Those are much more the kind of red flags that that make me sort of stop and take notice as a primary care doctor.
So how did you come up with the idea of the directive, and how is it different from existing living wills or do not resuscitate or DNR directives?
Yeah, so I've been a primary care doctor for about 20 years now, and I've had many patients along those years develop dementia and have sort of been there in the exam room with families and patients, making really difficult decisions about the medical care that we should be giving. And so many of those patients have filled out advanced directives or living wills in the past. And so in those really difficult in the moment situations of trying to imagine what if this person were this patient were still completely able to understand the medical decisions that they're facing and could make them themselves, what would they be choosing? And it's really, really hard. And so we go back and look at the living wills or advanced directives that many of those people have filled out. And the reality is that the way that just about all standard advanced directives are written, they don't really apply to what if I were to develop dementia. That they're very focused on pretty specific and important but very rare conditions like a persistent vegetative state or a persistent coma, but don't really speak to what if that person had dementia.
All right. And of course, dementia and Alzheimer's, can affect a lot more of us. During a 2012 TED Talk, global development expert Alana Shake told the audience that her father has Alzheimer's and that she is changing her life with the expectation that she, too, will eventually develop the disease.
If the monster wants you, the monster's going to get you, especially if you're me, because Alzheimer's tends to run in families. So I'm preparing to get Alzheimer's disease. Based on what I've learned from taking care of my father and researching what it's like to live with dementia, I'm focusing on three things in my preparation. I'm changing what I do for fun. I'm working to build my physical strength. And this is the hard one. I'm trying to become a better person.
So these all sound like really good and worthy things that one should be doing. But of course, she doesn't mention the thing about preparing for what happens once she gets it. How should she be cared for? So break down for us your advanced directive. What are the four levels of care options that you lay out for patients to choose?
Yeah, and that was one of the most difficult things in designing a directive like that, in that dementia is a really tricky and unusual disease in that it progresses really slowly over many, many years. And so it would make sense that as people would go through those different stages of dementia, that the goals of care that they would want for their medical care might gradually shift. And so having a directive that's just like two boxes, sort of, you know, either do everything or just focus on comfort-oriented care only, doesn't quite capture what most people really would choose for themselves, which is a gradual shift in what their goals of care would be. And so in addition to the two ends of the spectrum, which are, you know, I would want all care which is reasonable that would keep me alive longer, and I would want care only focused on keeping me comfortable and treating symptoms like pain and shortness of breath. There are two intermediate choices that people can make along that spectrum. One being, I would want care to prolong my life unless I had a cardiac arrest or a respiratory arrest and was unable to breathe on my own. Then I wouldn't want my heart restarted. I wouldn't want to be hooked up to a ventilator or a breathing machine. And then another intermediate step, which would be, I might want care to keep me alive longer as long as it could be provided in the place where I was living, but I wouldn't want the potential stress and trauma and complications that can happen from being from going to the hospital.
And do you encourage all of your patients to sign a directive like this? And how do you see this as helping patients and their families?
Yeah, I mean, so it's an interesting story how when I was initially developing this, I thought it would be really, really most useful to offer to people at the very earliest signs of dementia, because that's the point at which you're pretty sure that you're going to need a directive like this. You know, but then those conversations turned out to be pretty difficult, because I think even in that very early stage where you're just able to detect cognitive impairment, which is more than just normal aging, it's a really difficult cognitive mental leap to imagine a future mental state of yourself and to then say, if I were in this future mental state of myself, this is what I would or wouldn't wanted in these complex medical scenarios. And so I really started offering it more and more to people who do not have any signs of cognitive impairment. So, you know, I think really everybody, when they turn age 65 or 70, really should be offered a directive like this. And, you know, I'm really careful. I don't want to say that I should encourage everybody to do it. I think it's a very individual choice. There are some people who have very clear ideas about what they would want and really sort of jump at the chance to have a structured form to express those wishes. Lots of people, this is not their cup of tea, you know, and I would offer it and I might encourage it to some extent, but it's really important to meet people where they are in terms of how much they want to plan for their care, how much they want to express their wishes.
All right. We have callers on the line already. I want to bring in Joni, who's calling from Augusta, Georgia. Joni, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. My question is, I think the advanced directive, while you are of sound mind, is an excellent way to go. I'm in a situation where I have caring for a couple of people. My question would be, because when you have dementia, some days you are lucid and some days you are not, so should the patient who maybe has an outside influence, not a family member, or maybe an outside influence that can talk the patient into doing something, would the advanced directive override that? And should I send that advanced directive to all the people that handle her finances, her medical doctors, and all that in her life?
Thank you, Joni. So, Dr. Gaster, she seems to be asking, you know, will the advance directive always be obeyed? And with whom should she share this if she's got family members signing one?
Yeah, that is such a great question. I mean, that is really the central issue that comes up when people talk about a directive like this. And I think the most important way to respond and to think about a directive like this is that it is really this is a communication tool that allows somebody to express what their wishes would be to help to inform future decisions that would be made by their surrogate decision maker, their durable power of attorney, and the clinicians taking care of them. So this is not a legally binding, set in stone document that would override a decision that's made in the moment, because the medical decisions in the future are they're myriad. There's so many different scenarios that could arise that it's really important for any advance directive, but especially one like this dealing with a disease like dementia that is so variable and waxing and waning.
All right, Dr. Gaster, very briefly, because we're about to go to a break, but I imagine you must face some resistance that not all patients want to sign something like this. Tell us very quickly how you deal with that.
It is really up to the individual. If somebody does not want to fill a form like this out, then I absolutely would respect that decision and think it is a completely reasonable choice to make.
This episode of On Point is supported by 23andMe. This Valentine's Day, give someone special a DNA kit from 23andMe. They can receive over 75 detailed online reports about their genetic ancestry, inherited traits, and even information about their health. Go to 23andme.com/onpoint to get 20% off each kit, now through February 14th. Offer includes free gift wrap.
You have access to the entire world of NPR with your smart speaker. Ask it to play NPR or your local NPR station to check the news while you get ready for work or fix dinner. There's a new radio in your house, and it's easier than ever to listen to Morning Edition, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and more. Just ask your smart speaker to play NPR or your local NPR station.
This is On Point. I'm Indira Lakshmanan. We're talking about Alzheimer's, dementia, the latest research, and how to care for those who are suffering. You can join our conversation. Are you a caregiver to someone with Alzheimer's or dementia? What effect has caregiving had on you? Or are you worried that you, too, will fall to this disease? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. With me from Seattle, Washington, is Dr. Barak Gaster. He created a dementia-specific advance directive that healthy patients can fill out so that doctors and families know how much medical care they want if they're ever diagnosed with dementia. You can find a link to that form on our website, onpointradio.org. And joining me now in the studio is Dr. Risa Sperling. She's director of the Center for Alzheimer's Research and Treatment at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. She's also professor of neurology at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Sperling, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you for having me.
So I want to ask you, this advanced directive and this disease have hit a personal note for you, Dr. Sperling. Tell us a bit about that.
Well, my grandfather developed symptoms of Alzheimer's disease at the time I was applying to medical school, and I swore I was going to really make a dent before anyone else in my family was affected. But my father died of Alzheimer's disease just about 2 years ago.
I'm so sorry.
Oh, I appreciate that, but I realize this is what many families face. But I've all too personally experienced what Dr. Gaster was speaking about, and so I think it's a really important initiative.
And did your own father or grandfather change the way that they wanted to be cared for over the course of their disease? Did they have any sort of an advance directive in place?
My father, from the time I was a sentient being, told me that he would not want to live with people having to take care of him in a very infantilizing way. And so although at the time he never really made a formal directive, he told me from a very early period that he wanted not to be a burden and that he didn't want significant care to prolong his life if he developed dementia or some other debilitating disease. As he developed more and more symptoms and lost awareness, I tried to again have conversations with him, and it became clear that it was difficult for him to understand the nuances that he had told me about before. Mm. So I really think that being able to make these decisions and discuss it with your family and formalize it at the time that you are still cognitively intact is critical.
I wonder, you know, for you weighing this, because on the one hand, you're a researcher into Alzheimer's cures and treatments and medicines. And so you're probably, with every step of the work you do, hoping that there is some way to make things better for people who are already suffering. At the same time, you're encouraging people to put their wishes out there up front about how they would want their end-of-life care to take place.
Absolutely. The irony of this when my father was suffering with this illness really got to me. But I remember a very specific instance when he was approached about having dialysis because his kidneys were failing, and really thinking hard about this because it's one of those subtle intermediate cases, as Dr. Gaster mentioned. But I thought back to what he really would have wanted and what he told me over time, but it was very hard to make the decision not to proceed with dialysis at that point.
Mm. All right. Well, I want to bring another voice into our conversation, someone who thinks a lot about care for dementia patients. Joining us now from Chicago is Dr. Darby Morehart. She's a professor at the of Cognitive Neurology and Alzheimer's Disease at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. She's also a clinical social worker. Dr. Darby Morehart, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I want to ask you, you must find that having patients and family members talk about dementia is hard. You know, what about having that conversation about the advance directive? How would that help that conversation?
Yes, it's very hard to receive a diagnosis of a neurodegenerative illness that there, unfortunately, we don't have treatments for to really make or improve. And so having that conversation regarding an advance directive is exactly what we need to help frame our conversations around decisions for medical intervention throughout the course of the illness, and the earlier the better. I mean, it certainly helps both the person with the illness and the family understand the expectable pattern of dementia and organize themselves around the illness and anticipate what's going to potentially happen in the future. And so the importance of that communication as early on as possible is imperative. I heard what Dr. Gaster said, though, about how difficult that is, because in the very earliest stages of the illness, it can be very difficult to have these decisions and to think about that future self.
You know, your program at Northwestern has many different tactics to try to make it easier for dementia patients to talk about their disease and to cope with it. One of them is a storytelling project. Margaret and Mark Zumdahl are participating in it, writing and performing the story of their life together. Let's listen.
The history that we have together, the story helps bring that out.
Doing it as a partner, as a team, then it made it very fun. We laughed a lot. We cried a lot.
We did.
A lot of emotion in that. If I can say this, if it makes sense, it makes you remember your memories, because we could talk about them and enjoy them all over again and write them down.
So in that case, it's actually Margaret Zumdahl who is suffering from dementia. Dr. Morehart, tell us a bit about why this program has been so effective in your view.
Well, this program started a few years ago when families were coming to us and saying there aren't images of who we are living with this illness. We don't see images like us out in society, and we want to tell our stories. And so we ended up finding a master storyteller in Chicago who volunteered her time to conduct an 8-week storytelling workshop where the family, the dyad, the couple, and the couple can be spouses, siblings, parent, children, where they go through the the course of the 8 weeks, you know, constructing, reconstructing their, the history of their life, what's important to them, the day they got the diagnosis and how that felt and what that experience was like. And then they talk about the future living with this illness and often talk about that they realize they're more than their diagnosis and they have a lot of life to live. So this storytelling workshop, when we first offered it, we realized that there was something happening to these relationships as they were going through this process, that they were becoming closer to each other, that, that there was a greater intimacy and their overall quality of life. And we also then that story, as you can tell, and just as you've shared today, that their story now is being told to others. So there's a lot of others throughout throughout society that can now listen to what this it's like to live with this.
And I know that there are other projects similar to this. There's one called Memory Well, which was started by a former Time magazine journalist whose father mm-hmm. suffered from Alzheimer's. So there are a lot of different efforts out there to try to help Alzheimer's patients tell their stories and remain connected with their families. I want to bring in some listeners because so many people want to get into this conversation. It's such a personal thing. John is calling us from Meriden, Connecticut. John, go ahead. You're on the line.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
I'm calling because I have two comments. One of them is that I was diagnosed last July through a PET scan at Yale New Haven Hospital with Alzheimer's disease. I'm 66 years old. I'm a widowed gay male here in Connecticut. My neurologist calls it MCI, mild cognitive impairment, yet the report from radiology states clearly Alzheimer's. It was really upsetting, but I asked to be diagnosed. I was having memory problems that could not be explained in any other ways. They did all the normal rule outs, and we had the test, and I kind of knew what the results would be, yet when I got them, I was still shocked and upset. And I realize now, I mean, this was back in July, I realize now there's a hell of a lot of people wandering around out there who probably would qualify for the diagnosis if they had the brain scan. They just don't know it because they're managing fine. They have everything that they need to do, and it's going smoothly for them.
So is it helpful for you to have the diagnosis? And do you think that having that diagnosis, would you want to complete an advanced directive now knowing what you know?
Second comment that I need to make. Because of the diagnosis, I went to seek a friend. I didn't have any friends. So I started to look into who could be a friend. And the person that I did find who was very compassionate told me about the document they use where he works called The Five Wishes. It's a 12-page document published out of Florida by Aging with Dignity, and it's a beautiful guide for people that need to make advanced planning. It breaks it down into different categories and coaches you what to do, what not to do. It's recognized as a legal document in almost all of the states. And the states in which it's not recognized, you can still use it, but you have to supplement it with a couple of other things that are specific to the state. They have them for children. They have them for adults. They have them for adolescents. And it's just absolutely beautiful. And I've given them to, excuse me, my family and friends, yet I haven't been able to complete it. Mm-hmm. I haven't been able to complete it myself. Mm-hmm. I'm still stuck. But when I get to it, it's going to be a real big help to the people that are around me when I can't make decisions for myself. Mm.
John, thank you so much for sharing your story. It's you know, it's difficult to hear, and I really appreciate your sharing it with everyone. Dr. Morehart, I want to bring you in since you're a clinical social worker. What is your advice to John and people like him who are struggling with filling out a document like this, even if they know that it would be helpful to family and friends?
Yeah. Yes, it is very, very difficult to complete this. And again, it's very difficult for anyone. And I think it might be wise to just, take your time with it and to allow yourself and to have some patience with this whole process. You talk about not having anyone close to you. And years ago, when people were diagnosed earlier and earlier with this illness, what started in this country and around the world were groups that of persons who were newly diagnosed with early stage illness and now MCI. And we continue to offer these groups for people who come together and are able to recognize that they aren't alone. And it really does reduce that sense of isolation and that sense of being marginalized in a society where there still is a lot of stigma around cognitive impairment.
I'm glad that you brought up the question of stigma, because that is something I want to dig in and talk more about. But first, Dr. Sperling, I want to ask you, we all hope that modern medicine, as we call it, will find a cure for dementia. And yet just last month, Pfizer, major drug company, announced that it's ending its research to discover new drugs for Alzheimer's. Why? And that sounds so depressing and discouraging for everyone who's worried about Alzheimer's affecting them or their family members.
Yes, it's been a very challenging time for both researchers and pharmaceutical companies, and certainly for patients, as we've had a number of disappointing results from recent trials. But I actually remain hopeful, and it's partly because of what your listener brought up, that we are now able to detect Alzheimer's disease much earlier, before the stage of dementia. And although that is very difficult for a person to receive that information, it allows us to be able to potentially treat at a time that we might have a much better chance at changing the course of the disease.
All right, so tell me about that. Does that mean that there are certain medicines and certain treatments that are effective early on in this disease, or once you're showing symptoms, is it too late already?
Well, right now we don't have what's called a disease-modifying treatment, but we do have a lot of clinical
trials.
Meaning
we don't have a drug that's going to stop you once you've already got memory loss.
Yes, we have drugs that are helpful for the symptoms, and those are really important, especially at the stage of dementia. But what we need is a drug that's going to fix the underlying process in the brain. And what's most exciting to me is that we do have a large number of clinical trials ongoing, and we've consistently seen those move earlier to the stage of MCI and perhaps most importantly to people who are still clinically normal but have this buildup of amyloid that we can see on a PET scan. And just like cancer and heart disease, diabetes, being able to detect and treat disease before people come into the office with symptoms is a much easier thing to do.
So, Dr. Sperling, how do we know? How do you catch people at that early stage if they don't even know they have it? How would you detect that buildup of amyloids that you referred to? And what does that mean in plain English?
Absolutely. So we know that there's a protein that accumulates or builds up in your brain into these plaques called amyloid beta. And that begins more than a decade, perhaps two decades, before people get to the stage of Alzheimer's disease called dementia. So many people have a family history. Some people are a little worried about their own memory. They've noticed a subtle change, but they still perform normally. We did 4,500 PET scans in a recent prevention trial, and about 30% of people between the ages of 65 to 85 have evidence of this early plaque buildup. And that's exactly the group we want to be able to treat and ultimately hope to prevent dementia.
And you are working on some research into drugs that might help?
We believe that we have drugs that are biologically active against amyloid, and we need to try them at the right stage of disease, as in these prevention trials.
I'm Ophira Eisenberg. Join me on NPR's Ask Me Another as we challenge contestants and celebrities to nerdy word games, music parodies, and ponderful trivia. Find us every week on the NPR One app and wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Indira Lakshmanan. We're talking this hour about the challenges of caring for dementia patients and how to prepare to face the disease ourselves. You can join our conversation. What questions do you have for our doctors about your risk of developing dementia? Or what about preventing it? And what are you doing now to prepare for the possibility of the disease? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guests today include Dr. Barak Gaster, who created an advanced directive for dementia, Dr. Risa Sperling, director of the Center for Alzheimer's Research and Treatment at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, and Dr. Darby Morehart, a professor at Northwestern University and a clinical social worker. Before the break, we were talking about the stigma associated with mental decline and dementia. And Dr. Gaster, I want to ask you about that, because no doubt you must get some pushback. I'm curious what percentage of your patients to whom you present this advanced directive actually agree to sign it or even talk about it with their families? And how much do you think stigma is still a sort of barrier to our conversations about how we should be treated at the end of our lives if our minds fail?
Yeah, I mean, this is a really huge problem in that there is so much shame and denial involved in especially the early stages of dementia that is a real obstacle to providing good care. I mean, it is so important for families to be involved early in terms of planning and providing the support and social connections that patients with dementia have, and you know, bringing this disease out of the shadows into something that people feel more comfortable talking about is incredibly important. And you know, and yet it is on so many people's minds. I would say, in answer to your question, that the vast majority of people who I present this to are really, really interested. I mean, have very clear ideas of what they would want for themselves if they develop dementia, and so a very high percentage of people do fill it out and return it to me. I mean, since this has been receiving attention just in the past 2 weeks, more than 39,000 people have downloaded this directive from my website. In that, people have very clear ideas. They're really they jump at the chance to.
Well, I want to remind listeners that you can actually access this advanced directive that you've written on our website, onpointradio.org. I want to bring in a caller. Debbie is calling us from Knife River, Minnesota. Debbie, go ahead. You're on the line.
Hi, Indira.
Hi.
I'm a family physician, having practiced for 26 years, and we do talk to our patients about advanced directives. And I usually start talking to them when they're in their late 50s or 60s. And one of the points that I bring up is that it's important for the family not to be fractured or to be destroyed by decisions that would have to be made by, say, your children, should you not have advanced directive in place. And oftentimes I've seen families go after each other's throats because they feel differently about what mom or dad would have wanted. So I make the point that it's partly for their family that they should be filling this out.
Debbie, that's a really good point. I really appreciate that. Dr. Darby Morehart, you know, I believe since you work with families who are dealing with these issues, isn't that very much a part of it? If you have multiple children, they may have very different views about how your end-of-life care should be handled. And isn't this directive partly, you know, to prevent splits within the family?
Absolutely. This is Alzheimer's disease, other dementias. These are family illnesses, and it's really impossible to take the person with the illness or the person before the illness without having the family in that room and having these discussions together. Because ultimately, as this disease progresses, the person is not going to be able to continue that voice of what they want and don't want. So that family from the very, very beginning needs to be a part of that discussion. And as many people as possible. Now, as we know, families have lots of histories, and some families have lots of conflict in them. And so better to, as early as possible, try to pinpoint where those areas of difficulty are, so that one may have some sort of healing or resolution of some of those issues before it's too late.
Okay. Dr. Sperling, I want to ask you, there's a new book out called The Alzheimer's Solution by neurologists who run the Alzheimer's Prevention Program at Loma Linda University Medical Center. And they say that 90% of Alzheimer's cases can be prevented or delayed by diet and lifestyle choices. What's your response to this?
Well, I think it's a very important point to make that lifestyle can have an impact on Alzheimer's disease and dementia. Other studies have suggested it's closer to 50%, which I think is probably closer. But I think it's very similar to what we think about in heart disease. So not eating eggs and getting plenty of exercise has lowered people's cholesterol. But what really made a difference in our country in lowering heart disease and death from having heart attacks was the combination of lifestyle and taking statin drugs to lower cholesterol. So I think it's very important to think about these lifestyle and broadly, not just diet and exercise, but staying mentally and socially engaged as well. But I think we're going to need biologically active therapies as well, especially for people who have a genetic predisposition to the disease.
Well, it would be great, hopefully, if drugs are developed that do help. Although, as we talked about earlier, Pfizer, at least, is one company that has pulled out of looking for drugs for this. But give us, you know, just a handful, three tips of what we can do to help prevent Alzheimer's. Setting on ourselves.
I think that the evidence is actually strongest for physical exercise right now. So, and I tell my patients, as well as I try to remind myself, it's not just walking, although that helps. It's really actually breaking a sweat 3 to 4 times a week. And that can be of lots of different kinds of exercise. I also think that staying socially active and having a purpose is critically important. I don't recommend crossword puzzles or Sudoku. I'd much rather people go out and take up a new hobby with other people. And then the third thing is really having your life have a purpose. So I often recommend that if people are really worried about Alzheimer's disease, that they consider volunteering, either as a volunteer at the Alzheimer's Association or perhaps thinking about joining a clinical research study, because people really then feel that they have some control over helping fight this dreaded disease.
Great tips. I think we all need to follow them. All right. I want to bring in another caller. Go-on is calling us from Gungju, South Korea. Go-on, thank you so much for calling from so far away. Go ahead. You're on the line.
Hello. Hello, Indira. Thank you so much. I just want to ask someone, you know, question. Maybe it sounds a little bit out of tune right now, but, you know, my question is, you know, how are you, you know, instead of just a clinical diagnosis, how are you actually define, you know, definition of Alzheimer's or any memory loss in when it comes to identity? Because, you know, I had my family member who severely suffered from dementia and passed away last year. And I just wonder, you know, it was just so heartbreaking to witness her, you know, words are actually being, you know, so tenaciously held or being broken down in front of her eyes. And she, you know, struggled with dementia. I just wonder how you guys, you know, after observing so many different, you know, dementia patients, how you define this type of identical crisis in perspective of dementia?
Dr. Sperling, can you take that? That's a really interesting question, that it's an identity crisis for any of us who starts to lose the memories that center us as human beings, lose the connection to the individuals we love.
Absolutely. That's really the tragedy of Alzheimer's disease and dementias that affect memory and other cognitive function, because it robs us of who we are, our lifetime, of what it's built us up to be. But I think it's really important that we emphasize that there is still a person in there. And although they may not be able to form new memories, often talking about things with them that happened when they were 20 or 30, they relish those memories. And it's really important not to let that identity crisis become depersonalizing so that people don't feel that they have something to still offer, because they do.
Well, caring for people who have dementia, of course, takes a tremendous toll on caregivers. CBS's chief medical correspondent, Dr. John LaPook, spoke with Mike Daly, whose wife, Carol, has Alzheimer's. Let's listen.
What would you say the toll has been on you?
I'm dying. I really took a hit. My blood pressure is like 200 over 100. I can't go to the hospital. Who watches Carol? All right, what do I do with Carol?
I mean, it's just heartbreaking to hear that, because caregivers suffer not only because they're taking care of others, but they can't take care of themselves. And Dr. Morehart, I want to ask you, especially the sandwich generation, those of us who have young children and older parents, how do caregivers take better care of ourselves?
Yeah, that's such a hard question to answer. Caregivers are always telling me how much they dislike being told to take care of themselves. But it's much easier for us as clinicians to say that to our families who are caring for someone with dementia. But I guess it's really important to recognize that there's no one way of doing this, and that it's important to acknowledge that that you have your limitations. So this is an illness that really lasts. It can last a very long time, and it's like a marathon. You have to pace yourself over this time, and try to recognize that there are people and community services and places where you can get support and rest and respite. Research tells us that one of the best things that a family member can do for themselves is to have some time away. Mm-hmm. That time together is really important, and have that really valuable time where you can, you know, relish that relationship for as long as you possibly can, but then to also have that time apart.
All right. I want to bring in another caller. Dave is calling us from Stowe, Massachusetts. Dave, go ahead.
Hi, Indira. Thanks so much for this critical conversation. Everything I've heard is spot on. Unfortunately, I have personal experience with this. My father died of dementia in April of 2016. Mm. He saw it coming. He was a trained psychiatrist, very well respected in the Worcester area, had been practicing for 40 years there. He had always said that he wanted to have, didn't want to be kept on life support or anything like that if things went wrong. As he progressed in his dementia, you know, it took him several years. In the last 3 years, he had to be institutionalized. But as he progressed in his dementia, what he wanted changed, which was, you know, I want to live forever, or then later I want to die. And we had to interpret all of this. It was brutal. Not only to, I mean, just watching the process was brutal, but I thank God that I had my siblings to help me with this, but the wishes of the patient change, and, you know, how do you know what to respect?
That's a great question, Dave. Thank you so much. And, you know, you make a good point. It's brutal not only because you're watching your loved ones suffer, but also how do you know how to interpret what they're saying if they're saying different things? I mean, we had several listeners who have written to us about this. Kathy Ware Weber on Facebook said, is there a way to make the document legally binding to ensure that your wishes are carried out so that siblings or other family members don't cancel out the wishes of an aging parent? So I want to ask you, Dr. Gaster, since you've just written one of these directives, how do you interpret it if people change their mind as they go along in the process of losing their memory, and how do you make it legally binding?
Yeah, so I mean, it's going to be really difficult to make a document like this legally binding. I mean, like as I said before, it is so crucial to see this as a communication tool to give a structure, a space for a structured conversation for you to have with your future decision makers, because those future decision makers and your future self and your clinicians are going to be in a really complex, always shifting, sort of waxing and waning scenarios, where this document that you fill out now is going to be incredibly important and useful to help to inform those future decisions. Mm-hmm. And so really, you know, as just getting back to one of the questions that somebody asked at the beginning about, you know, who should I sort of share this with? Who should I talk to about it? And that is really the core important point, is that this is to help to initiate conversations and help you to document your wishes. But it's those conversations which will ultimately be the most important, because those are what people will look back on along with this document to help to make those difficult decisions in a very, you know, these are heart-wrenching situations where things are shifting.
Yeah, and some of our callers have some suggestions as well. Some of our listeners, Ken from Seminole, Florida, says that his mother died of Alzheimer's, his wife has Alzheimer's, and it's so important to give a power of attorney while you still can to someone else who can take care of your decisions. And another listener, Cammie from Yellow Springs, Ohio, says that her mother had Parkinson's and dementia, and it was so hard for her because she didn't know she had dementia, and she fought in home care. And Cammie wishes if only they had had an advance directive, it would have been so helpful. Dr. Sperling, let me ask you, from your own personal experience, how does having a parent with dementia affect the decisions that you make about your own life? I imagine you must worry about getting Alzheimer's, given your father and grandfather had it.
Well, I try not to worry about it on a daily basis, because I have to say that worry is not one of the things I'd recommend for helping keep your brain healthy. But I do feel this tremendous sense of urgency, not just for myself, but for the millions of people who are entering the age of risk for Alzheimer's disease, that we have to get more aggressive in finding a successful treatment and hopefully solving this terrible disease before it hits another generation.
Dr. Risa Sperling of Brigham and Women's Hospital, also joining us, Dr. Darby Moorhart of Northwestern University, and Dr. Barack Gaster of the University of Washington School of Medicine. Thank you to all of you for joining me today and talking about such an important and personal issue for all of you. All of you listening at home can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Indira Lakshmanan. This is On Point.